Lost in Tokyo, a story in 6 parts. This is part 4, Joji Obata. Nestled on the Japanese coastline, Zushi Marina exudes an air of alluring secrecy. Its craggy cliffs and serene waters concealing untold mysteries beneath their very surfaces. We dance round in a ring and suppose, but the secret sits in the middle and knows. As Katie Vickers stared at the Zushi Marina apartments, she knew that this was the place Koji had taken her. After this trip, the police took several more women out to the apartments. Krista, Clara, and Isobel all identified this as the place they had been drugged and assaulted. But none of the girls could remember an apartment number or even which of the buildings the apartment had been located in. The task of going door to door was out of question, and instead, the police ran criminal record checks on every apartment owner in the complex. And out of all the apartment owners, only one had a criminal record for sexually based offenses. The owner of apartment 4314 had 2 arrests on his record in October of 1998, just 2 years prior. He had faced apprehension for engaging in voyeurism, caught in the act of filming a woman within the confines of a ladies' restroom using a handheld camera. This marked the 2nd instance of his involvement with such an unsettling predicament. Within the man's criminal dossier resided his mugshot, an image that proved instrumental in tracing back to his driver's license photo, thereby confirming his identity. Subsequently, the astute detectives embarked on identifying every vehicle registered under his name, and their inquiries unveiled a complex network. The man emerged as the president of multiple companies, a fact woven into the fabric of various properties scattered across the expanse of Japan, each company bearing his name. Detectives created a photo lineup containing the man's photo, and they had each of the victimized women take their turn looking at the lineup. Each one of the women picked the same suspect without hesitation. Detectives began tracking one of the man's vehicles, a white Mercedes-Benz SUV, using the intricate network of surveillance cameras that monitor Japan's highway systems. They were able to confirm that he had traveled from Tokyo to Zushi on the day Lucy Blackman disappeared. In the days after Lucy's disappearance, the man made several trips back and forth to the city. The police superintendent, Udo, decided to keep the man under strict surveillance, and he had 10 police officers at a time keep a tail on this man. To avoid suspicion, the police were undercover, and they used different modes of transportation. One officer would follow the man in a car, and then several blocks later, the next officer would pick up the tail, but he would be on a bicycle. It was very Charlie's Angels. What was not very Charlie's Angels was the amount of times the police officers lost the man while following him. And so, as fate would have it, the inevitable occurred on a fateful day while the man was leisurely cruising the streets of Chiba, slipping through the police's grasp. The next day, a letter arrived at the Azabu police station, postmarked from Chiba. It was incensed and written with copious amounts of foul language, all punctuated by the audacious signature, Lucy Blackman. Superintendent Udo was confident that they had the correct suspect, and so they began tracing his background and his movements over the past few weeks. He owned properties all over the country. Many were investment properties with renters who lived in them. But many of them were his personal residence, including three homes in the central Tokyo area alone. He owned a two-story house with a pool and a home in the village of Moroisu on the Miura Peninsula, located just 16 miles south of Zushi. The coast of Moroisu graces the Miura Peninsula with a striking fusion of rugged allure and tranquil beauty. Rocky outcroppings punctuate the shoreline, their weathered forms standing in contrast to stretches of soft, sandy beaches. The Carillion waves of Sagami Bay tenderly meet the land, their rhythmic dance painting a serene backdrop against the craggy terrain. The suspect owned an apartment in a building named Blue Sea Abaratsubo. Maybe one standout difference between the United States police and the Japanese police is how well they cooperate between departments. Here in the United States, it is almost non-existent. In Japan, it is no big deal. And because of this, when the Tokyo police contacted the Misaki police, they were faced with a story no one was ready to hear. The Misaki police received a complaint on July 6th from the caretaker Misabe at Blue Sea Abaratsubo, and so they dispatched three officers to the location. Misabe told the officers that just that morning, a strange man had shown up and entered apartment 401, an apartment which had been unused for several years. This man did not have a key to open the door to the apartment, so he called a locksmith, who came and opened the door for him. The man left his two-seater Mercedes parked alongside the building. Miss Abe's partner, Mr. Hirokawa, stated that the sports car was filled with lumpy objects covered with white sheets. Miss Abe told the officers that the man was still in apartment 401, and they had heard some unusual noises emanating from the apartment all day. As the officers approached the apartment door, they too could hear the repetitive thumping coming from inside of the dwelling. They knocked at the door. There was no reply. The officers pushed the electronic doorbell and they spoke into the intercom, identifying themselves as police officers. The door groaned as it opened, and there, in the doorway, stood a short, middle-aged man with thinning hair, clothed in nothing but a pair of pajama bottoms. The man's face and chest were flush, and he was sweating profusely. The man told the officers that he was going to change clothes, and he shut the door. The officers heard more of the banging noises from within, and then the door opened again. This time the man was more presentable, but in his hand he held some sort of tool. One of the policemen stepped into the apartment. From the genkan, the officer noticed several strange things around the apartment. However, this man refused to allow the officer's entry to inspect his home. He kept insisting that he was simply retiling the bathroom. Just like in the United States, the police in Japan cannot randomly search through your home without a legal warrant. And so, with no right to enter the man's home, they left and walked back down the stairs. Now, you may be asking yourself why this story was so shocking. And that is because this is when it gets really weird. As the officers were walking back down the stairs and away from apartment 401, suddenly the man emerged from the apartment once again, and he called for the officers to come back up the stairs. The officers obliged, and as they ascended the stairs, they could see that the man was now holding something wrapped in some newspaper. As the police stood in front of the man, he held the bundle of newspapers like a baby cradled in his arms. As he unwrapped the top of the papers, they could see something strange. The man was holding the frozen body of a dog. The man explained, "My beloved dog died. I thought you'd think it strange if you saw this body, so I didn't want to let you in." The Misaki police never followed up on this man with his mysterious dead dog, and just a few days later, when reports began circulating about a missing girl who'd been driven out to the seaside, the Misaki police also made no connections. As the search for Lucy Blackman intensified, letters began showing up at the Azabu police station. Between July and October, 6 letters were received, and these letters only served to add to the mystery surrounding this case. 2 of the letters were scribed in perfect English, and each of these letters were signed with the same forged Lucy Blackman signature of the previous letters received by police. One of the letters was written in Japanese, and this letter was 8 pages long. It was supposedly written by an acquaintance of Lucy's, and in this letter, the author explains that Lucy suffered from schizophrenia and that she had multiple personalities. The writer of this letter also goes on to explain that Lucy was drowning in debt, and so she had turned to prostitution in an effort to pay off these debts. At the beginning of October, the police received an envelope which contained 1,187,000 yen, or around 1,200 US dollars. A letter accompanying this money, and signed once again by Lucy, explained that this money was to be used to pay off all of Lucy's debts. The letter explained that the money was to be given to Lucy's sister, Sophie, and Sophie would oversee paying off all of Lucy's outstanding debts. Even with detectives tailing their chief suspect in this case, they were never able to observe him sending these letters, nor had they observed him pulling so much cash from his bank. One thing the police did learn was that on October 1st, this man bought a boat. The man had purchased a 20-foot Yamaha fishing boat for $33,000, and it had been delivered to the Seabornia Marina. This marina was just a few hundred yards from Blue Sea Abaratsubo. The man traveled to a fishing store and purchased an anchor and a lot of rope. He told the shop owner that he needed to be able to anchor the boat in very deep water. Just 10 minutes after the man left the shop, the police entered the store and asked the shop owner to tell them everything that had just happened. Now, Superintendent Udo had something to seriously consider. Why had this man purchased a boat? And why did he need so much rope to anchor the vessel? Udo's educated guess was that the man intended to dispose of Lucy's body out at sea. The suspect was being followed by the police detectives, and the evening of October 11th, he spent the night at one of his homes located just a 10-minute walk from Roppongi Crossing. That evening, Superintendent Udo laid down for bed, knowing that the following morning, his officers were going to arrest this man, and they would finally be able to solve the case of the girl who was lost in Tokyo. Superintendent Udo was awakened by his phone ringing at 3 in the morning. When he answered, he was a bit taken aback by who was on the other end of the line. It was a journalist from the Yomiuri Shimbun, the world's best-selling newspaper. This journalist informed Udo that they were planning on running a front-page story the following morning about the imminent arrest of a suspect in the Lucy Blackman case. Udo knew that his officers needed to react before the morning papers hit the convenience store shelves. At 6 a.m., the officers who had been conducting surveillance on the suspect's apartment observed the man stepping out and making his way to the nearby convenience store. After a brief period, he emerged from the store, carrying a stack of newspapers. In that moment, law enforcement swiftly moved in and apprehended the individual. He was taken into custody under suspicion of being involved in the abduction and assault case of Clara Mendez, dated back to March 31st, 1996. During the arrest, the officers also noticed the headline on one of the newspapers, which announced the apprehension of a 48-year-old businessman and company president named Joji Obata. Joji Obata, finally, a name to the suspect that police had been tailing and now have under arrest. But who is Joji Obata? There are almost no photographs that exist of Joji Obata as he looks in the year 2000 or after. In fact, the only photos that anyone could find of this man were from his youth, when Obata still thought of himself as an attractive man. Joji Obata's birth took place on August 10th, 1952, to Zainichi Korean parents in Osaka, Japan. Zainichi Korean refers to people who are ethnically Koreans, but who live in Japan, particularly those who have been residing in Japan for generations, but are not Japanese citizens. The term Zainichi literally translates to residing in Japan, and it is often used to describe various ethnic groups living in Japan. In this context, Zainichi Korean specifically refers to people of Korean ethnicity who have been living in Japan for an extended period, sometimes spanning multiple generations. These individuals often have a distinct cultural identity and can face unique social and legal challenges due to their status as non-citizens in Japan. In his early years, Obata's father transitioned from being a scrap collector to becoming a notably affluent proprietor of multiple properties and pachinko parlors. Pachinko parlors are very prominent entertainment establishments in Japan, where players engage in a game that combines pinball and slot machine elements. These parlors, which vary in sizes from small local shops to sprawling complexes, house rows upon rows of pachinko machines, creating visually and audibly stimulating environments. These establishments also typically reek of cigarette smoke. Pachinko parlors operate in a legal gray area in Japan due to restrictions on gambling for cash prizes. Instead, players receive tokens or prizes that can be exchanged for cash nearby. They are culturally significant as pachinko parlors have been an iconic part of Japanese urban life, though they have also faced scrutiny for potential gambling addiction concerns, and discussions about potential industry reforms persist even today. Obata received his education in esteemed private schools in Tokyo, supplemented by daily tutoring across a range of subjects. At the age of 15, he enrolled in a respected preparatory school associated with the Keio University, essentially ensuring his admission to the university. Following his father's death in Hong Kong, when he was just 17, Obata inherited properties in both Osaka and Tokyo. After extensive travels and the completion of his studies at Keio University, with degrees in politics and law, he took the step of becoming a naturalized Japanese citizen and formally changed his name. Obata directed substantial investments into real estate projects, accumulating assets that were estimated to be as high as $38 million. The economic downturn of the 1990s led to Obata's financial downfall, resulting in a loss of his wealth and his businesses during the recession. This prompted pursuits from his collectors, and there were reports suggesting that Obata was using his businesses as a cover for money laundering activities connected with the Yakuza syndicate, Sumiyoshi Kai. Superintendent Udo did not have his officers take Obata to the Azabu police station. Instead, they took the man to the Tokyo Metropolitan Police headquarters in Kasumigaseki. The Tokyo Metropolitan Police building in Kasumigaseki is an imposing building that marries modernity and tradition, its glass and steel facade reflecting the city's energy. Towering spires evoke vigilance, while within, wood-paneled chambers house a blend of history and functionality. Just hours after his arrest, hundreds of Tokyo police officers were dispatched out to 20 of Obata's properties all over Japan. They began searching the apartment in Zushi Marina, the property at Blue Sea Abaratsubo, where they had encountered Obata clutching his beloved dead dog. Obata's home in Roppongi, where he was arrested, and his large house in Denin Shofu, where he had a private pool, just to name a few. Local Japanese news stations had sent their news helicopters to capture live images of the police performing their work. Japanese citizens sat in their homes and watched the footage of police officers scouring through Obata's properties on their local news stations. All told, the police recovered over 15,000 pieces of evidence, and Superintendent Udo planned on supervising the logging of every piece of evidence himself. Obata would be held in a solitary cell in the Tokyo Metropolitan Police headquarters, awaiting what would come next. In Japan, a suspect with an arrest warrant can be held for 3 days. This period can be extended by a judge for 10 days, and this can happen twice, keeping the suspect in holding for 23 days. After this time, a person can be incarcerated incommunicado, meaning they would have no access to lawyers, family, or friends, without any charges being brought against them. Japanese criminologist Setsuo Miyazawa writes, "The whole system is designed and implemented in such a way that the suspect will offer apparently voluntary confessions to his captors." And this is how detectives and prosecutors work in Japan, under pressure to obtain a confession. In Japan, confession is king. Even hard-hitting physical evidence is considered secondary to a suspect confessing. To elicit these confessions, in the first 23-day holding period, detectives will hold a suspect in an interrogation room and simply ask the exact same questions over and over again. The suspect will stay in the room, and the officers will just rotate out, so there is always a fresh officer to continue asking the questions. This interrogation technique was exactly what detectives used against Joji Obata after he was arrested on October 12, 2000. As I said, in Japan, confession is king, and that required a suspect's cooperation. The problem the police were having was that Joji Obata refused to cooperate whatsoever. As he was brought in for processing, Obata gave his fingerprints when asked, but he refused to look at the camera for a mugshot. As he stood for the photo, he would only look down at the ground. The police could not physically force him to look at the camera, or the photo could look as if he was being tortured by the police. So once again, there was no usable current photos of Joji Obata. Another thing I want you to remember is that Obata does have a law degree, and he understands the law and his rights extremely well. And he is about to prove both of those things to the police. Obata was under arrest for the abduction and assault of Clara Mendez, and according to law, the police have to keep their questioning to that topic alone. The true nature of Obata's arrest was to try and find out what happened to Lucy Blackman. Was he holding her somewhere? Was she still alive? Or had she been killed? But the police could not ask him these questions. Outside of the formal police questions, some of the officers would attempt to have side chats with Obata, in which they would bring up Lucy Blackman. However, aside from confirming his name to the detectives, Obata never said a word and spent every moment he was held in the interrogation room invoking his right to remain silent. And this is how things went for 2 weeks. Now the extended holding period was about to expire. Obata would still be held in a detention center while his case was going through the courts. However, they would not be able to continue this style of questioning if they lost Obata to the detention center. So, the detectives came up with a plan. They charged Joji Obata with the rape of Claire Mendez, and then they immediately rearrested him for the assault on Katie Vickers. And now they could start the entire process of questioning Obata again for another 23 days. The month ticked by. Each day, Obata was questioned by a rotating staff of detectives, and each day, Obata sat in silence, giving up nothing to those detectives. While this took place, thousands of pieces of evidence were being picked through and cataloged in another part of the building. Detectives had to hope they could build a case on evidence if this suspect were to never confess to his crimes. And let me tell you, the evidence in this case was quickly beginning to mount. Detectives had collected a lot of hairs from Obata's Zushi Marina apartment. Those hairs were tested against DNA samples collected from Jane and Tim Blackman. The results came back and confirmed that some of the hairs belonged to Lucy Blackman. So they could confirm that Lucy had been in Obata's apartment. Amid their investigation, detectives also stumbled upon a cache of undeveloped film rolls within the apartment. Within this treasure trove, they uncovered a poignant revelation: the final snapshots ever taken of Lucy Blackman. In two of these photographs, Lucy stands poised on the apartment's balcony, the vast expanse of the sea stretching behind her. Across the bay, the town's buildings punctuate the landscape. Lucy is clad in a short black dress, a heart-shaped pendant necklace gracing her neckline. A pair of sunglasses perch atop her head, and in her right hand she clasps a beer. From this frozen moment, an illusion of normality prevails. Police analyzed these photos, and through some detailed recreation techniques, they determined that this photo had been taken on July 1st, 2000, the day that Lucy Blackman disappeared. The next item of interest was a man purse, which are a very common accessory for Japanese men. This bag contained two items of interest. One was a gas bill. Scribbled on this gas bill was the phone number of the burner phone used to call Luis and Scott. Remember those phone calls Luis received about Lucy joining a cult? They came from the phone number on this receipt. Also in the bag was a baggie of a mysterious white powder. After testing, the detectives learned that this was a drug commonly known as Rohypnol, which is also known as the date rape drug. Detectives also found a cache of GHB and 13 bottles of chloroform. Next, the police discovered receipts from several shopping trips Obata took on the days following Lucy's disappearance. 20 pounds of dry ice, a large packing box, three two-man tents, a folding table, a 7-gallon cooler, 3 bags of cement, a chisel, a hammer, gloves, plastic bags, an axe, a handsaw, and a chainsaw. And then they found the notebooks. Police now have Joji Obata in custody. But where is Lucy Blackman? Will she ever be found, dead or alive? Join us next week on The Secret Sins as we continue our harrowing story. Until then, we dance round in a ring and suppose, but the secret sits in the middle and knows.
Today's episode of The Secret Sits was researched and written by the host, John Dodson. All episodes are engineered and mixed by me, Gabriel Dodson. Check the show notes for links to all of our social media. Email us at thesecretsitspodcast@gmail.com. And don't forget to leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts.